Samuel. Well, let's turn to Psalm 45 for this evening and the last of these songs of the heart that we're going to look at for this year. I think it's fair to say we all enjoy a day out. Whenever you came from where I came from, Newcastle was a day out. I know everyone here drives through Newcastle to try and get to their day out, but our Sunday school excursions went to one, do you remember Sunday school excursions? Yes, it went to one of three places. It went to Portrush, it went to Bangor, and it went to Newcastle, and that was the cycle that it went in. So you could always guarantee where you're going, and we all enjoy it, don't we? We all love getting away from what is the normal, what is the routine. And it doesn't matter if it's up the coastline to another seaside destination, doesn't matter if it's to a town or a city to do a bit of shopping, or indeed it doesn't matter if it's a day out in a forest park or up in the mountain, we enjoy getting away. It's just not like spending a Saturday at home. We like to get onto the road and we like to move. We like to go somewhere with intent that we'll have a good day. But a day out isn't simply about going to the seaside, as nice as that is, or going to the shops, or going out into the forest or the mountains. There are special day out, or days out, when we get specifically asked to attend an event. That, for those involved, will be a day that they won't ever forget. And it all starts with the postman coming and popping an envelope through our door that is inscribed with the most beautiful fine print. It has our name on it, and inside, when we open it, is a wedding invitation. Of course, if it is the man of the house who's opening it, then it'll simply be passed to the lady of the house. And of course, if it is the lady of the house opening, even before she has read the date, she will already be thinking what outfit she will have to wear. And after many outfits later, well, that's how it goes in our house, the day arrives and you're ready to go out on your special day to the wedding service in the church that you've been invited to, and then to the reception, because there you are invited to be a witness to the marriage of two people who are deeply in love. And you are a witness to they committing to each other because in each other they have found their companion and partner for life as they covenant to each other and to God in holy matrimony. You see, on days like this, on a wedding day, we enjoy spending time with friends, we enjoy good food, and we enjoy a good party, all part of the celebration. Everyone goes to a wedding not to be grumpy, not to be sad, but with joy in their hearts, but also with an expectation that it will be a good day. And in all honesty, we haven't really been able to introduce any of our psalms this summer with a joyful tone. Our psalms have been real. They've been honest. I hope the psalms have been helpful. I imagine, and this is not a judgmental statement, but I imagine, as it was for me, there are some of those psalms perhaps you've never even read before, didn't even know existed. Yet what they have allowed is for us to be honest before God, because God has given us the words by which we can be honest with. That's the thing about the psalms. They're not made up by man. They're given to us by God so that we can express in the language of God what is deep within our hearts. And so after all of these psalms that have led us down that path of rawness, we now come to a celebration. This psalm, this concluding psalm for this year, being so much different, is really a perfect psalm to finish on, because it's not a psalm of lament, but a psalm of celebration. It's a psalm that speaks of the King, only to be used in due course in the history of God's people as a song for our waiting people as they look for the Messiah, but also a song that we can strongly sing ourselves because of what it means for us as we know Jesus Christ, our risen Savior. So let's get into God's Word this evening. And as with most of the Psalms in Book 2 of the Psalms, it is attributed to the sons of Korah. They use the tune Lilies, which was also called Lilies of the Covenant. Now, for those of you who know how the psalm, the metrical psalms work in our own hymn book, you have it, it's a hymn book that's cut in half. You can flick the bottom pages and the top pages and can match whatever tune you want to whatever psalm you want as long as it's in the same meter. You'll not find the Lilies of the Covenant in our metrical psalms. No one knows what that hymn sounded like, but it's or that tune sounded like, but it's not the only time that it's used in these psalms. This tune, Lilies or Lilies of the Covenant, is used in Psalm 60 and in Psalm 80 as well. So this is a well-known psalm tune to the people of Israel, one that they would go back to and one that they would use now for a celebration such as this. This is a royal psalm because it's penned for a royal occasion. It's a hymn of celebration for royal weddings, not just one, but most likely many royal weddings, and not just for the king who was to be, but also the rest of the royal family as they would be in marriage. The title that we have here ensures that we know what we're going to be singing about. Notice those last three words. It's a love song. This is something that's to capture our hearts, that's to stir our hearts, that once again gives us words by which we can express what is deep within our heart before God. And it's impossible to be sure for which king in David's line this song was first written for, but it doesn't really matter. Because after 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verses 11 to 16, the line of David was the appointed channel through which God would bless his people and carry out his mission to the whole world. And as we will see in our conclusion tonight, this psalm has a direct messianic meaning because Hebrews chapter 1 verses 8 to 9 references verses 6 to 7 of this psalm, applying these verses to Christ, taking this psalm and placing it firmly in this New Testament age that we will know that this psalm is truly speaking about Jesus Christ. And so the psalm itself is naturally divided into two parts. Verses 1 to 9 speak of the glories of the king, while verses 10 to 17 give us the duties of the bride. And we must remember that this psalm serves three purposes. First of all, it serves the original purpose of celebrating the wedding of the Israelite king. It is a psalm that was sung for such occasions. Secondly, it's also a post-exile or a post-exilic psalm that the people would have sung that time from coming out of exile to the time before Jesus came. It was the purpose of it was waiting. They didn't have a king for whose wedding to sing at, so it was about waiting for the ultimate king to come. It was a psalm that had deep messianic meaning for the people as they came out of Babylon. And thirdly, now in our age, a psalm for our time, because in this psalm, through the eyes of the New Testament, we have the knowledge of the love of the eternal King and our duties in response to his love. So it's a psalm for all three periods of what is our history, and so we will attend to it as such. So we'll begin in verses 1 to 9 and the glories of the King. The psalm commences in verse 1 with an introduction of setting the scene. And this verse gives us an insight into the purpose of the sons of Korah. It seems like they're a type of Old Testament poet laureate. And they're the ones penning this song because of the pleasing theme of the love that the king has for his bride. It's going to be a national song. And so the sons of Korah have been tasked as almost a poet laureate to write it. And what they do in the following verses is to describe the king as a truly wonderful man, a king who excels by far the reality of King David and all his heirs throughout Old Testament history. So we can be sure as we read it tonight that it's not about a human king. Rather, it is pointing us to the great king, to King Jesus. And here is how the king's glories are seen. In verse 2, we read of his physical attributes. He is described as the most handsome of the sons of men. He has a physique that makes heads turn. But the depth of man, of this man, of the king, is not shallow as so confined by his looks. The verse goes on to say that he is a man of character. and celebrating the beauty of the king's lips. They're not talking that he had luscious lips and nice lips, but what they're saying is that how he speaks is beautiful. He has a winsomeness about him. He speaks with wisdom, and he is known for his speech. This is what makes him great, both the physical looks, but also the wisdom that he has that comes forth from his lips. In verses 3 to 5, then, we read of the success of his battles. He is a skilled fighter, but he's not just a skilled fighter, he's also a valiant leader. He rides out to lead his armies, but when in confrontation with the enemy, he is skilled in how he handles his weapons. Verse 5 tells us, "Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you." So he is a good marksman. And here's a king who will overcome evil with good and win the victory, as verse 4 tells us, of truth and meekness and righteousness. So understanding this verse in the context of our time, we will see our King Jesus lead the battle against sin, and he will win the victory over sin when he rides in majesty, in lowly pomp, to die on the cross, as the hymn Ride On in Majesty by Henry Hart Millman tells us. So even in these opening verses, we're looking beyond the earthly king to great King Jesus, who is the one who will lead the charge against sin and who will ultimately defeat it. Next, in these verses, we read of the stability of his throne at the start of verse 6, followed by words of how he reigns. The psalmist here is telling us that this is a good king.